listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Chris Mueller is a national speaker, author, father of six, and is currently making a Catholic TV show for families as he travels speaking to over 10,000 people each year. Between Chris having over 18 years experience in Catholic lay ministry and Timmery's holding a master's degree in biblical theology, together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery.
Hello, my friends. It is good to be with you again. I am so excited because this week I have a special guest with me in studio, Dr. Philip Chavez. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So for those who don't know who he is, I just spent this past weekend working with him up at the Masculine Genius Institute and just the profound contributions that you and all of your presenters had to masculinity and kind of reclaiming it for ourselves. And, you know, this specific conference had to do with the Finnish man, that 18 to 22 year old range.
Right.
Great content, but you can find more about Dr. Philip Chavez over at the Men's Academy. I'll be sure to post links in the show notes as well. But for anyone listening live, be sure to go check out radiotrending.com where you can get those links and all the episodes, because you might only get one episode a week of Trending in your area. But otherwise, for you guys, Dr. Philip Chavez's work can also be found at the Men's Academy Press, which that website is mensacademypress.com. So this week, lots coming up. There have been some major successes in the issues of human life, both in California and across the United States. A lot to work on with regard to China. And I always want to bring good news with some challenge as well, because especially how we're crafting the conversation.
Sure.
We'll also be talking about appearance, physical appearance. We've been working through this book by Shanti Feldhahn and how really a woman's appearance still really matters to the spouse, especially as years go on.
Sure.
And then in the meantime, I want to start today by discussing the sex abuse scandal.
Sure.
You know, we've been a little light on it the last couple weeks on Trending, but this past week, so much has continuously come out here. But this past week, over the weekend, Archbishop Vigano released another letter.
Not
a lot more information, but I thought it was very fatherly in a time when we need a leader and a father stepping in and saying, hey, we're still kind of pushing forward, addressing the issue.
Yes.
And I need to hear from more people here.
That's right. I think he's inspired other, hopefully other prelates and priests to step up. You know, there is one point where he talks about how the silence of pastors itself is a devastating crime. So I think what he's trying to achieve here, in at least in part, is that he's exhorting pastors of all types to step up and to come to understand that, well, you know, there may be certain times we kept certain privacy for some things, but outside of confession, you know, if it's really to protect the body of Christ and not, as he says, defend the church from her enemies, then we're justified in doing so. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was a good point. So I think he empowers other pastors, if they could see that vision, some of his other other things he describes and how to approach this in terms of coming forward. I think that's what he's trying to inspire pastors mm-hmm. to do.
Step up, do something.
Exactly.
And so he's calling on pastors, we need you to do something. You have the power to approach your bishop. The bishops have the power to approach bishops and cardinals, to approach the Pope. And, you know, he addresses, and I personally will say I've been dissatisfied with the response from the Pope and the issue of sexual abuse, and even from some of our bishops. There have been some incredible bishops who have really spoken out, and I'm
sure.
just saying praise God, because we need to hear that. But I think that the purpose, in my opinion, of his letter really was to say, hey, I'm here with you. I'm willing to take whatever suffering might be endured through this. I want you to know that I'm calling, you know, the Pope. I need to hear more from you. He's saying
right.
the bishops who have documentation of this need to come forward. And he gives us a beautiful example of a picture that he chose during one of his ordinations, I think, to becoming a bishop by GP2. And he uses this image, and it's really the image of Jesus calling Peter onto
yes.
the water. And it's so beautiful because he talks about how as Jesus is before him, as they're in crisis over what's going on in the boat, they're also, oh, because they're waking him up. That's what it is. They're waking right. Jesus up in the boat because the storm's gotten wild. And at the same time as he's being woken up, he's also the entire time behind them twice in the picture. So he's depicted mm-hmm. standing behind the apostles, but also sleeping in front of them.
Sure. Yeah. And I think one of the things Vigano is trying to inspire, as you alluded to, is he's trying to inspire the prelates of the church to work with the Holy Father. I don't know where Vigano's position is on the lay faithful expressing their voice so much as I think he's really trying to press the hierarchy to step up here. And in some way, that is the most appropriate way of dealing with the Holy Father and dealing with the College of Cardinals, is that those in the closer positions to them, in some way, it's incumbent upon them the obligation to confront these things. It's more incumbent upon them than it is us, the laity.
Looking at this, Philip, the laity, most of the people here listening, sitting in your car, maybe you're getting ready today. These are all great places to listen to Trending, wherever you might be, maybe you're cooking, who knows where you are. You're processing the sex abuse scandal. You're sitting here going, you know, what's going on? Why did this happen? Why is it? And I myself am just, I mean, I think being re-scandalized sometimes, even though I'm not surprised, unfortunately, as I have friends who are priests who are saying, yeah, this has been going on. And,
yeah.
And you know, I was talking to a friend recently and he was talking about the work in Chile. And when he was there and he said, it was just assumed that if you were a seminarian in Chile, that you were same-sex attracted and acting out on that.
Right. This is a huge problem in the sense that there's so many facets to the causation of where we are today. You know, the sorrowful part of this, at least it's an inception with the hierarchy of the church. Fundamentally, it was the upbringing they had that caused this psychosexual disturbance. Many of them had very absent fathers because of the wars. Men were very distant. They were distant emotionally. Not as much talk about father-son relationship. Many things were very commandment-based instead of personally based. A lot of teachings of the on sexuality in the schools and in the seminaries were very rigid, harsh, unyielding, bending. And so there was a culture of fear when it came to things of human sexuality. And so many of these cardinals and bishops who were having difficulties with, they went through these minor seminaries. And you see, there was no real vision, first of all, to form a man, but there was no vision either on that was really for a healthy psychosexual development. So there were many factors that contribute to the difficulties we face today. And unfortunately, I think it's the case that it's one thing to talk about how the genesis of the homosexuality started, but I think what's most important is to talk about how it was able to keep going, how the whole ship was able to continue to move forward in this culture of secrecy, even for those priests in the know.
Tell us what you think about that.
Yeah, fundamentally, I think if we had a more emasculated clergy, we wouldn't have the problems we had today, the presently experienced today. One of the fundamental reasons is that if men stood up as men, then the homosexuality would be checked. And I think what's happened, because we don't have a real definition, strong and vibrant, of manliness, then homosexuality just really is, well, it's just another expression of sexuality that's different. And so when authentic manliness rises, it of its nature checks a homosexual disposition and would have checked that homosexual infiltration. But the difficulty is, as I said, when it comes to the clergy and their silence, I firmly believe that it's happened from an emasculated culture that started in the seminaries that continues in priestly life.
And like it doesn't matter if I say something.
Well, on a deeper level, what happens is I don't think that's as much as, well, when we get into the roots of this, is that the seminarians and the priests, they live a very comfortable and soft life, okay? They're catered to. They feel like they're in a privileged position. And fundamentally, because of the softness of life, it's softened them as men, mm-hmm. and then softened the virtues which should be inculcated in them, and fundamentally which is to lead, to protect, and provide. So I think what we have is a bunch of clergy who live in a kind of a soft world in virtue of what they don't want to stand up, or they can't, or they don't have that, you know, the fortitude to do so. And so if they did, I think a lot of this would have been checked. So without a real vision of manliness moving forward in the seminaries, I don't see how any of this will really recover. We can cut out the cancer in the body, but if the body's still the same, it's just going to grow right back.
It's a bit of a pessimistic view.
Well, it's optimistic in this sense. It's optimistic in this sense that if we can get that vision of manliness in the seminaries, that's what would really resolve the healing and the regrowth of the church in a very steadfast way. And along that, along those lines, that's where I think the laity can help. You know, I think a lot of movements we've seen in the last 20, 30 years, again, catechetics, apologetics, theology of the body, things like this, they were movements started by the laity. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things going on started by the lay church in the last, well, 30, 40 years, even a lot in the last 20 years. So lay people do have an important role to play in rebuilding the seminaries, because if they can rebuild their sons as men in the parishes, and when these men go in, I believe that's the way the church is really going to recover, and it's really going to come back with any kind of strength if it does.
Well, and that also includes, you know, people who are willing to teach in the seminaries.
Sure.
And what their expectations are of the seminarians. And total side note, but I've heard a number of men I've spoken to about this. Man, these men going into the seminary need some form of true boot camp to really get them through of this physical side, because we're body and soul.
Exactly.
Not just soul, not just body. I think the world, the secular world, wants to treat you as if you're just a body, when sometimes the Catholic, the spiritual world, just wants to treat you as you're a soul and the rest doesn't matter.
Sure.
But we're a union of the two. And
yeah.
That's when we're truly happy. You know, even just
exactly.
The endorphins that kick in our heads when we're exercising, when we're physically active, when we're competitive. It's so good for our psyche and for our spiritual growth.
I think that's right. And yeah, that physicality is important on a number of levels. I mean, like you say, adrenal level or whatnot, it tends to boost up a man. I mean, I never feel good as I do, like, say, after a run or when I used to box, you know, after doing some rounds, you just feel great. Even though you've been hit, it just feels like you've come alive. I remember one time not too far from here in the Borrego Springs Desert, I was caught in a lot of thorns and just a real rigorous area that was amazing. I didn't wind up in the hospital afterwards, but I felt like $1 million after getting through that climb. So yes, the physicality, when men don't have it and they're not challenged by nature, men need to be challenged in many ways on the number of virtues, but if they're not challenged physically, it's proven and shown they will physiologically decline, and all their bodily and therefore their psychological operations will also decline as well.
That's a very profound statement. I think that this is something we're seeing both in men in the church and also men. You know, there are all these women looking around going, saying, I would love to date someone.
Yeah, that's right.
But there's a lack of interest. And so same thing, you know, men take note. That's Dr. Philip Chavez. I'm Timory Millington. He's from the Men's Academy. You can check out his work at mensacademypress.com. You know, we're talking about the sex abuse scandal. And, you know, you're saying that what we need is a reform ultimately of the seminary to see a change in the clergy.
Yeah. And a reform really of manliness in the lay people, because the priests will only be formed in such a way that they see a paradigm of manliness already lived in the community, it seems to me. Mm. Now, that being said, too, the seminaries really do need to spell out what it is to form the man and the priest. I don't think they've ever gone there, any seminary anywhere in the world. In other words, it's one thing to talk about, and as many church documents do, they'll talk about character formation, but they never really define the character that they want formed. In other words, I really believe that the seminaries do need a concerted vision of manliness in the priest. As a matter of fact, I think, going even farther, that vision of manliness should be just a vision that any lay person should be formed in. In other words, all men should be formed even as natural fathers, natural leaders, defenders, and providers, no matter what their vocation. All men need that fundamental formation just to be a good man and father. And I think we've missed that in the seminaries, thinking, well, he's just going to be a priest. He's going to preach and hear confessions. He doesn't need all those other qualities and traits of manliness. On the contrary, really needs that. Mm-hmm. If not for just inspiring the fathers that are in his own congregation.
And if he doesn't have that, he's not living to his fullest potential.
That's
as
right.
A man.
That's true. That's true. And that'll have its effects on how he reaches out as a priest, prophet, and king.
Right.
No doubt.
North Dakota Diocese Bismarck is really interesting. I've worked with a Father Josh Waltz, who is a vocations director out there. And this guy is just a total man. You know, it's interesting hearing the young boys and how they relate to him and hearing the conversation, how everyone looks to him as a leader and for this great conversation. I have a lot of respect for Father Josh Waltz. But what's interesting is his seminary where he's recruiting for has a very high number of people coming in. And it's because how he's inviting them and how he's calling them in and how masculinity is fundamental to that call.
That's right. That's right. And in the sense that, hey, guys, this is going to be hard. You know, the sense this is going to be difficult. And men want to rise up to that. They don't really rise up to that, which is easy. And if they do, you certainly don't want that kind of man in the seminary, right? Remember the Irish years ago, and those who know me have heard me say this many times, the Irish never had problems with vocations as long as the boys were boxing. And so they used to box in these church groups and whatnot. In fact,
there are church groups of boxing?
Exactly. Well, everything in old school Ireland was kind of surrounded by your church anyways, okay? Sure. So, but yes, this one priest I know, Kevin Wallace, down in San Diego, you know, he was raised in a culture where, yes, all the boys boxed. And so as when they were having boys boxing, and you can imagine uniting the faith with that, teaching the faith of the boxing glove, getting priests inside the ring with boys, which the Christian brothers used to do back east, we'd have plenty of vocations. We would not have a vocation crisis. I believe boxing is a very visceral sport, which when men learn it, they can really stand up and grow in those virtues. And the difficulty is, like for which causes our present crisis, the priests don't want to take a hit. And there's something about manliness where a virtue just isn't something theoretical. If we learn how to take a hit in the boxing ring, we can learn how to take a hit in life. It's just that simple.
And what to do when that hit happens as well.
Yeah.
Do we just take it? Do we respond?
Exactly. And to not fear that hit when it lands. Mm. If anybody is boxing a ring, they know they can position themselves such that if they move slightly, they know a blow is going to land. They cannot fear that. So there's many dynamics on boxing. I could talk for quite a long time about that. So it's one of my favorite sports. But in any case, it's just these visceral things, you know. And two, priests who hunt, who camp, some of engage in martial arts, even weightlifting to a certain extent. These are all very, very healthy things for their priesthood.
Did you hear about the priest just a few months ago who was on American Ninja Warrior? Did you hear about that?
I heard about that. I don't watch TV, but
yeah,
that much.
I don't watch a ton of TV. I didn't get to see him on. I don't think he made it very far. However, what was so cool about this priest is in his testimony, he was sharing that you know, he doesn't watch TV. He doesn't do a lot of other things, you know, for extracurricular relaxed time. So people criticize him because he spends a decent amount of time at the gym. Mm. But he said, that's part of my ministry, too. Yeah. I go and people see a priest there working out. All of a sudden, you know, if I'm visiting a prison, I have a conversation. Maybe I might be working out with the inmates or playing some basketball with the boys. Like, it's been a part of my ministry. And it's just so interesting because you think, oh, you know, he's a priest. He doesn't need to do that. You know what I mean? Or not in excess.
Yeah, and it's interesting, is it's part of his ministry reaching out specifically to men. Hmm. You see, when a priest, if he can understand when he reaches out to men, that affects everyone in the family and their children, all the rest. Once you bring the men in, they bring the families. Hmm. So yes, to win them over and to win their respect, to get involved in those visceral things of manliness or physical strength, it's very attractive to men.
So what do you think the ladies' role is moving forward in light of the sex abuse scandal?
In terms of what they can do on the long term, it is moving with, as has done when there was a great need of catechetics in the late 60s and 70s, you had organizations arise to start reviving solid catechetics again. I think there needs to be lay organizations that come to the fore who talk about authentic manliness and authentic femininity, which is something, you know, I'm engaged with, and to some extent you are too. So getting these teachings out there and bringing forth activities to build up young boys and men and really for authentic femininity as well. But there's great opportunities. I understand some of the present problems with the scouts, but the scouting program at its core is very valuable for boys. I think there needs to be more outdoor things available for men, even at the parish level. And again, like I say, we could take this world back for Jesus Christ. We just brought boxing back into the parishes. I'm dead serious.
I love it. Yeah. I think it would be great. And I mean, look at so many people are coordinating their lives around extracurricular activities. And I think part of the new evangelization, we've talked about this in many ways, is bringing deeper involvement back into the church. You know,
yes.
I grew up in a small community, and every Friday during Lent, where were you? Stations of the Cross. You know, you have that soup supper, you know, during the week, catechesis, youth group, you know, daily mass. Your life did in many ways surround around what was going on at the parish.
It did.
And if you add in, okay, boxing. Here we go. It's time for the boys to come. They get to be around other men of varying ages. Of course, I know we've got to say it. Great accountability, watching eyes, mandated reporters. Yes. But, you know, having a healthy sense of relationship for people.
Sure. And I think in the past, the church was a little more focused on divine worship, and properly so, and did have so many of these ministries. But today, I think they're very much needed in the parish and very much needed in guiding men in ways to form young men. And I think, yes, the parishes today are need to incorporate those things. And the men's groups, Catholic Men's Fellowship or the Knights of Columbus, these guys need to be stepping up, not only just to form the men in their ranks, but to form the boys in the parishes. I think that could be their most important work.
So you've mentioned boxing. What other things could you see being good projects for men's groups? Because I sometimes think maybe they don't know what to do or where to start.
Sure. Well, again, outdoor programs. I know of a man, in fact, who spoke this weekend, Dave Bogan. He organizes activities for youth to go to certain shooting ranges.
Yeah.
And so things like that. Again, many outdoor things are very, very valuable for boys to learn. You know, and too, I think men need to be creative, too, and to figure out how to teach men to use their hands, young boys, mechanics, simple things of the home. You know, your average young man today can't really wield a hammer well or even a screwdriver.
Or how to fix a, you know, leaky faucet or whatever
exactly.
It might be. Maybe classes at the parishes of, hey, we're having a workshop on, you know, how to change your oil, whatever it might be.
And even how to rescue others. They're choking. They're, how to rescue somebody in a first aid situation. Because I must say, I mean, I do a fair amount of hiking and outdoors, and I'm not prepared the way I should be in understanding the basic things of first aid, which I should be learning myself. And I'm sure if I did, I would feel a sense of empowerment and a little more confidence to go out. In fact, even maybe to be a little more bolder, take more risks. But in any case, many of these kinds of skills and activities I think would be great for men to be creative and revive in the parishes.
Total side note, just fun conversation. So my dad has worked a lot in the park systems, working, developing some major counties and trails all over San Bernardino County, Southern California area. And so we did a lot of hiking growing up in the mountains and, you know, a lot of hiking alone at times, you know, and running across animals. And it's so interesting moving to San Diego. There are a lot of great opportunities for hiking, but people are aghast when I go hiking by myself and, you know, men and women. And I'm going, well, if you know what to do, you know, you have some good ideas and skills, you're fine.
Sure.
You know, you're fine.
Sure. And it's important we take that initiative. I mean, it may not be always the perfect scenario, but we do know that that's what Jesus did too, and it's very healthy. You know, we have the benefits, and I wasn't sure if we spoke about this at one point, but the Anza-Borrego State Park, the second largest state park in the country, looks more like the Holy Land than any place I've ever seen. And so I go out there, and if I can use the words, I'll have my Jesus experience out there. I understand what it was to go out into the desert and to be formed, to pray to God. Boy, what a great place to open your heart up to God. I'll tell you what, that would be very transforming for men to utilize that which they have down there, to just learn how to pray to God in the peace and the quiet of their own hearts.
It really poses the importance of silence in our lives.
Yes.
And, you know, there's so many things that can distract us. Where are you planning an opportunity of silence?
That's right. Maybe. That's right. And of course, what does our Lord tell us? You know, go into your room and close the door, and the Father who sees you praying in secret will reward you also. Mm. And I think men need to learn that one of the primal ways they connect with God is at home. Sometimes men think that, no, I really connect with God when I go to church or before the Blessed Sacrament, or that's not really true. I think the most primal way of encountering God is in your own home, in finding quiet there, if at all possible.
You know, and I think that for each of us, I know myself included, I have to plan that time.
That's right.
When am I?
Intentionally
going to be silent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been in oblate formation, which is like third order formation, essentially, for the community of St. John. And part of what our responsibility is to have a period of desert. And ideally, that would be once a week. But depending on your state in life, maybe it's a chunk of a few hours here, or maybe it's a whole day once a month, whatever it might be, to try and fit it in there. But silence, you know, that self-discovery and that conversation with God, that is so important. In studio with me is Dr. Philip Chavez. We're going to be coming back discussing a lot about abortion and just what's going on, the great successes in our country right now.
Chris and Timory will be right back. Tweet them at C. Mueller Tweets, spelled M-U-E-L-L-E-R, and at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Dr. Philip Chavez is in here with me in the studio for Trending. You can learn more in the show links at radiotrending.com and check out other episodes where Dr. Philip Chavez joins us in studio. I want to talk about some of the major successes coming up here in the pro-life movement in our country. It's great news, Phil. But first, I want to talk, you know, in light of the sex abuse scandal, I know that you've mentioned that you kind of had to say, okay, you know, we're ready to point fingers and look out and make changes, but maybe we first need to point that finger in and reevaluate our own lives.
That's right. And that happened to me, I think, 4 years ago. Many of us maybe started following with the scandals like a daily reality TV show. You know, what's next? You know, what dirt can I find today? And I mean, quite honest, I found my heart a little toxified by that in the sense that I was a little too immersed in that. And then searching my conscience, there was something that just inspired me to think, well, gosh, if I'm being so critical, harboring such criticism over maybe prelates who haven't protected others, regardless of who they may be through their own actions, what am I doing to protect others, even in my own community? And that was very, my conscience was very much struck by that. And I used to be very much engaged in the pro-life movement in the past, and I haven't so much in the last few years. And so I really realized, yes, I had to get back out there. So one of the things I realized, yes, if I'm in a disposition of criticism about bishops or prelates or whatnot in the church, I've got to clean up my own house. And a big part of that was to engage back in the pro-life movement. And I'm realizing, gosh, if I'm not defending the vulnerable in my own backyard, how can I expect or judge others who aren't protecting others, you know, from lands farther away than I live?
You know, who's suffering around me? Who is in need? Because, you know, those we are criticizing in the church have turned their eyes, turned their ears, turned their reporting, closed a blind eye, you know, and yet we have people dying just streets over from us.
That's
in an
right.
abortion clinic.
That's right.
What are we doing? You know, and we have, you know, laws that are being passed in this country, or not even laws, but decisions that are being made by high government officials that are ultimately destroying human life, and we can speak up.
Yes, yes. And what's to be said about a man who's a protector that can't protect innocent life in his own community? I mean, if we're not stepping up to do that as protectors, how can we expect God to bless us in any aspect of our lives, our families, our churches, our communities? So getting first things first, it's the most vulnerable in our community are the unborn. Mm-hmm. And if we're not taking up that battle there, we're not really taking up battles where it needs to start.
Absolutely. I want to talk about some excellent news. So here in the state of California, we've had a number of really tough laws we've been facing the last year. One of them was Senate Bill 320. And what mm-hmm. Senate Bill 320 was doing is it was basically going to be one of the largest expansions of abortion in this country in quite a while. It was going to provide the medication RU486 mm-hmm. abortion pills to any public university college campuses in the state of California. And so basically, girls could access abortion, yeah. the abortion pills very easily. There's a lot of detriment to the process of RU486 on the woman's body, not
right.
to mention it's killing a human mm-hmm. life. There have been women who have died from taking RU486. There's a significant impact of hemorrhaging. I have friends and people I know who have experienced hemorrhaging. I mean, blood clots the size of baseballs. Mm. And women who will not go to the emergency room through the process because they're thinking, I inflicted this upon myself.
Mm.
I chose to kill this life. And it was shocking just over the last couple weeks that the Senate actually was able to pass this bill to expand abortion, just free access to abortion on college campuses to young women.
Yeah.
Saying that this is what they needed to get ahead in
yeah.
life.
And again, I think, Timory, this is just the fruit of a deeper emasculated culture and deeper loss of the protector. And again, when all the, when all these things fall apart, when a man's office and a woman as well, these things are only corollaries of what happens. Because unless we really foster the man and the woman's role and really come to respect and revere that, we're going to lose respect and for the reverence of human life.
Yeah. And so, you know, I want to talk about this because there's good news that the light of this tunnel, it passed through the Senate. Guess what? Our governor, Governor Jerry Brown, actually vetoed this bill this week. This was just phenomenal to hear that he did. I mean, against all odds, I mean, especially after we've faced physician-assisted suicide over the last couple of years, some of the abortion and LGBTQ legislation that's come out, the fact that he vetoed this and basically said it's not necessary. You know, California really does protect abortion in the state, the right to abortion, and within every college campus, university, there's an abortion clinic within at least 5 to 7 miles of the college campuses. So women don't need this. It's not necessary. He vetoed it. And I'm just going, praise God.
Yeah.
All the people who reached out to him, who used logical arguments that maybe weren't just having to do with the fact that a baby's life is dying and a woman's body's being damaged, but he heard it and we've got to thank him for it.
Yeah, I think so. And just inspires you too to keep in the fight and just know the prayers, action, and whatever we can do to participate, that's going to make a difference.
Yeah. And that's the second time in the last week that we've seen a difference being made, because the FDA this past summer ended up signing a contract the Trump administration has decided to completely step away from. So what was going to happen is basically the government was going to be participating in purchasing fetal baby body parts for research on mice to try and create
humanized mice or something.
Yeah. Human immune systems.
Yeah.
And so basically the Trump administration has said, no, we're ending this deal. But why? Because people spoke up.
That's right. Yeah. It's you know, these atrocities and what it would take. I mean, the insidious whole background to all of this, you can imagine what, you know, I mean, part of this was discrepancies and difficulties over the way these fetuses were actually being bought by other clinics and resold to the government. You know, so many hands are dirty in this whole process. And, you know, even the parts I read, too, were about the difficulties also with how the tissue is being handled and the protocol for this. And, I mean, what kind of protocol do you have for handling the bodies of babies who have been taken by abortion? It's just hard to imagine all that had to go on to keep the industry prepped for this kind of act. But it's so good it's canceled.
Well, and you know, we've got to talk about it. Praise God it's been canceled, but we've got to talk about some of the specifics here. Did you know that in order for them to do this, in order to do this research with the mice, and it's still being done, maybe just not by the government now, you'd need babies at the gestational age of 17 to 22 weeks or of 20 weeks to 24 weeks. That is a very, very developed child. We know the sex of the baby. We can see the full outline and development, fingers, toes, arms, a full skeleton. Everything's present that will have already developed within the womb. It just needs time to be further nourished and grow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's important we be alerted to that. And again, it's, gosh, the deeper we get into this kind of emasculated culture, we lose respect for femininity, masculinity, the role of husband and wife, and the fruit of love, which is procreation and the beginning of life. The more we get away from that, the more these kinds of violations against human life will continue. And yeah, so even at all these levels, we need to be fighting it at even these incipient issues and problems, because it just is one way to recover a sense of respect for life, respect for community, society, family.
Absolutely. And you know, these are great successes, things to be celebrated, but we have to remember, as we're celebrating these moments, that there's much more that we have to do. And right now, the political landscape, especially surrounding quote-unquote women's rights, women's reproductive health care, it's very polarizing, even within friendships and families, maybe within marriages themselves.
It is.
And, you know, a couple of talking points that I want to provide to you guys is, it's really good that this contract has been nullified, because the government had a vested interest in particular women aborting their children. They needed those children to be aborted in order to get what they needed to harvest the babies. And we saw this with the major expose by David DeLeiden a couple years ago that they would spot women, oh, she's at a gestational age of about 24 weeks. We need her baby. We need the brain of her baby. Mm. So that changes how we perform the abortion.
Sure.
And that changes, what if she doesn't want to stay in that clinic at that moment? They have a vested interest, both the clinic in her aborting and now also the government.
Yeah.
And so that takes away choice.
Yeah, it's a shame to think that these are motives to actually justify abortions for this types of research. Just shows you again how diabolic the whole abortion industry really has led itself into.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I want to challenge you guys. We need to remember, you know, just this past week, we saw the 38th anniversary of the one child policy in China. And, you know, looking at this, there have been conversations that maybe, you know, they're going to change. They have a quote unquote two child policy now, which you still have to get permission in order to have children in many instances. Even with that two child policy, it's not completely a two child policy. But there had been an announcement that they're looking at abolishing that policy. And the government's come back saying, oh, no, we don't plan on changing it. But what's interesting is that China's facing a demographic crisis right now. You know, they have over 37 million more men than women.
Yeah, the repercussions of that, I think, are many. On one level, I'm afraid of that they may develop a stronger army. But on another level, too, most of those who have been aborted have been baby girls. And I think what the fruit of that, too, has been an even deeper disrespect for women in that culture, where widows and others have been left destitute, I think, because the men generally have lost a sense of, well, if we're not going to protect, you know, the young, vulnerable little girls or babies, why should we even protect those who have become older and therefore found themselves on their own?
Absolutely. Phil, it's great having you. We have one segment we're coming into. We're going to be talking a little bit about evangelization, what that looks like, and then also how women, the responsibility women have, at least in the man's eye, to continue to care for her body. And so we'll be talking about that a little bit more on Trending.
You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery.
In studio with me is Dr. Philip Chavez. He is from the Men's Academy. You can check out his work at mensacademypress.org. Mensacademypress.org. We are talking here a little later about the responsibility and just how women, you know, you have to continue to take care of yourselves and your bodies and how much this matters to men. We're continuing that conversation from Shanti Feldhahn's book, For Women Only, What You Need to Know About the Inner Lives of Men and What They're Thinking. But I want to pause first and talk, you know, in light of the sex abuse scandal.
Sure.
There are truly a lot of opportunities for evangelization where conversations are coming up in ways we didn't have before.
Sure.
People are coming out as closet Catholics are embarrassed to share that they're Catholic in these situations.
Yeah.
And I was listening to something that you had said before about, especially for men, and you know, all of us that we have this call, but especially men, to be fishers of men. That's part of the masculine role.
Yes.
How do we evangelize and do that right now?
Yeah, well, any attempts in evangelization shouldn't be such done, I don't think, in a defensive way. In fact, I think to avoid these topics with others, non-Christians, I think is a good idea, if at all possible, to not dig into that, because I don't really find much fruit there. But in terms of, reaching out to men, you know, it's interesting that, Jesus called his disciples by summoning them to be fishers, summoning them to be leaders. And I think when men are inspired in a way of leadership, that they can see the faith as something by which something in them can rise up, I think that's a great way to inspire them. Yeah, there's so many things I think that could still be done. You know, we talked about these various things men could be doing in the church. But in terms of evangelization, I think this whole crisis gives us somewhat of a renewed a vision or aspiration to reach into the world again. And for some reason, I mean, obviously we have to heal those things at home, but I think when we understand that, you know, the church should be about a witness to others above all things. And so when we recover that in some way, the church finds yourself in a healthier situation, that will highly affect a more fruitful evangelization.
Absolutely. So when you think about evangelization, I know one of the things I've seen is that this conversation has come up with people of sex abuse and maybe people where you just have never had a conversation about faith to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so it might start with someone making a comment like, oh, yeah, I think priestly celibacy to begin with is a sham. You know, depending on how you're open to that conversation taking place, you know, maybe it turns to God. And, you know, whether this person, I find the vast majority of cases, they're fallen away Catholics that I'm talking
to. That's right. Yeah.
And, you know, what do you believe it should look like for priests? You know, and what did Jesus call the apostles to? And if you start talking about the apostles, suddenly you start talking about God, and the door has opened in many circumstances. But again, you've got to feel out the person and where it could go.
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, there are all these questions that can be raised, and for the sake of apologetics becomes very, very important. Again, but I can't help but think too that in the kind of renewed vision we need for evangelization, sometimes it's not so much about what we do or say, but so as much as the image of Christ we're able to project. Yeah. You know, people convert not because of our great arguments or because we've got it together or just that we're the church of history or have these great channels of the sacraments, though the Eucharist certainly has brought many into the faith that I know of, but they're converted when they see Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And so this awareness that we're to move in communion intimacy with him is what really attracts in the end.
Absolutely. And ultimately, if you look at even what the church is saying about the new evangelization, when we look at what the church is saying, they're ultimately pointing to Christian witness. It's not what you say, but it's through your actions, through your conversations of where you're willing to maybe be silent and not press a point, you know, where you are willing to speak up, where you're willing to just show, this is how I live my life, and this is what we're all called to.
That's right. That's right. And I think, too, that's one of the reasons why maybe evangelicals or other Protestants may not be attracted to Catholics, because we've, in great measure, lost a sense that the faith really is about being in a communion, you know, through the Son, for the glory of the Father, accompanied by the Spirit, but that we move in Christian identity, and that at a very, and I'll use the terms, a very personal relationship, but when they see Christ in our communion with him, that's what really converts others.
Mm-hmm. Philip, I want to get your thoughts here. We've been working on trending on this book by Shanti Feldhahn. You've heard me mention it, for women only. And it's What You Need to Know About the Inner Lives of Men. So it's looking at the social studies on men. She is an incredible researcher. And this chapter that we're chewing on this week is The Truth About Taking Care of Yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because a lot of men actually commented, you know, talking about respect, talking about the burden he feels to provide, talking about so many elements of what's so important to him. This was actually the chapter that a lot of husbands wished his wife could hear.
Mm.
Because this was a chapter where, again, a lot of these topics they don't know how to communicate or share.
Sure.
And here's just one piece. 7 out of 10 men indicated that they would be emotionally bothered if the women in their lives let themselves go, didn't seem to want to make an effort to care about their body, their appearance, or even their energy level.
Yeah. I think whether a man voices it this way or not, you know, he always wants to be inspired. When he first met the woman that he's married, you know, she was inspiring. Her beauty moved him. There's certain qualities about her that moved him, certain traits that she had. And men don't want to see that die. They want to continually be edified. They want to continually be inspired, and they want to be proud of their wives.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing too, Timmery, I think it's important to understand that men are inspired, it's true, through virtue. And the more virtuous a man is and sees that in a woman and detects it, the more he's attracted to her and drawn to her and finds a true interior beauty. That being said, too, men are also inspired and edified when they see a woman who's actually very beautiful herself. Now, what's interesting, I find this is the case with chivalry. In other words, sometimes it's the beauty of a woman, not only physically and in terms of her character, that makes a man rise up and want to defend her. He wants to defend beauty, not because she's just vulnerable. There's something about her beauty that makes that chivalrous part of him stand up. And so a woman's beauty actually ennobles a man.
Mm-hmm.
It inspires him, ennobles him, and wants him to, more carefully defend her. where if she disregards that, then he's less inspired and less to fulfill all those things of manliness he needs to fulfill.
So wouldn't you say that beauty ultimately, you know, it draws and inspires men in, but he desires beauty, but that desire is also meant to help him ultimately step into that role of being the protector?
I think so. Yeah, because you want to protect that which is precious. Okay, so a precious looking woman, it just inspires him naturally. And like I say, too, on a deeper level, it should be her interior virtue. But men, being as physical as they are, that's usually the case. Another thing, too, and maybe I'm just speaking the obvious, but it just needs to be said. Remember that a man is around women all the time who are not very modestly clad. And so he's in a community where he's exposed, where nowadays we're very much exposed to women who, many women, and their physical parts of them. So we're immersed in somewhat of a pornified world. And so he needs his wife to keep, it helps when she kind of keeps up and makes herself more presentable, because it counters in some way that pornified world that can easily distract him away from her.
Right, and that doesn't mean being scandalously dressed. It means that there's a beauty, the interior beauty of who we are is meant to be the exterior-interior balance, right?
Sure.
The exterior beauty is meant to remind us as women to develop the interior beauty.
That's a good point, yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting, even in the dating conversation today, I know a lot of men who are very particular physically. And sometimes I come at, you know, maybe if you get to know someone, mm-hmm. the physicality will actually be more appreciated because you'll understand and appreciate the interior beauty more.
Yeah. What you say is true, I think, generally. However, what the difficulty is, what we're finding in today's men, they tend to be attracted not toward the more substantial, but actually the superficial. So I think this is one of the things we're running into. And again, you know, a man's exposed to this kind of beauty all over, you know, and so much what he sees. And so in the woman he dates, he wants to see someone who can, maybe I'll use the words compete with that. I don't know, live up to that.
Yeah, I think that men are looking for that, because a lot of men even see when a woman makes an effort, you know, this book really points to when a woman makes an effort to care for herself, she's choosing to exercise, choosing to eat healthy. He takes it as a great compliment, even though he knows she's doing it for herself. He also thinks, okay, she cares, you know, cares about our relationship,
yes.
cares about us. And he's proud to show that off.
That's
and
right.
commend that.
That's right. That's right. Men want to be proud of their wives. And obviously the opposite holds true. But yeah, it's something which inspires him. It makes him want to be a better man too. And that's something all men want to be challenged to. So yeah, and that any of that kind of I was going to use the word perfection or improvement or enhancement of her and her efforts to do so will inspire him to be a better man and do more things for himself and maybe even take care of himself as well.
Right, and he's not expecting that there's a size 3 or a size 5 woman in terms of clothing, or that, you know, you're always perfectly done up, but that there's effort, that there's self-care, that there's energy there.
Yeah, and that shows a sign of respect and care, and it's for a man, that's an expression of love.
Right, and I think it's something, you know, again, we've been working through this, you know, not to tout or criticize the way men function and think, but to appreciate and see, okay, this is something that I can learn from. This is something I can adapt. This is something I can talk to my sons about with
sure.
how they're perceiving who they're attracted to. Dr. Philip Chavez, any last parting words? It's been so good having you.
It's been great here. Thanks for having me.
So
I'm
if you would like to find out more about Dr. Philip Chavez's work, you can check out mensacademypress.com. He's also on Facebook at the Men's Academy. You guys have a great week. And to hear more with Dr. Chavez, please check out the podcast at radiotrending.com.
This has been Trending with Chris and Timmery. To learn more about Chris Mueller or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak at your upcoming event, visit everydaycatholic.com or timmery.com.